At the time of his death in 1962, E. E. Cummings was, after Robert Frost, the most widely read poet in the United States. But in the intervening years, his reputation has been dimmed, and now he's better remembered as a stylist with peculiar punctuation than as one of the preeminent poets of the 20th century. Susan Cheever's new biography, E. E. Cummings, A Life, which revisits the man and his work, is published by Pantheon Books. I'm very pleased it has brought Susan Cheever back to our show. Hi.
It's a thrill to be here.
What did EE stand for?
Oh, it stood for Edward Estlin. And it's sort of an interesting progression because he started his life and his life as a poet even as Edward Estlin Cummings, uppercase, uppercase, uppercase. And he slowly began to become E.E. Cummings, and then he slowly started using lowercase. So it was a progression. It didn't happen all at once.
And what led him to even consider doing that?
Well,
I mean, I can understand when you're typing. Right now, we see an awful lot of stuff in email and text messages with no capital letters because it requires an extra step.
Well, that's just sloppiness. This was the opposite of sloppiness. It was a very well thought out, well reasoned idea about the effect of capital letters on the reader's sensibility. And actually, it started with Ezra Pound, who was one of Cummings's poetic fathers and who used upper and lower case to signify importance. So Cummings started using upper and lower case to signify importance. And one of the most interesting things about Cummings to me is his use of the lowercase I, because that's where it really gets gritty, right? Are you an uppercase I or are you a lowercase I? And it's been suggested that Cummings's father, who was a great big brash sportsman and a Unitarian minister and a Harvard professor, was very much an uppercase I. Mm-hmm. And that in relation to him, Cummings felt like a lowercase I. But if you think about it, uppercase and lowercase are extremely expressive. And so he used them that way.
Well, in the title, the cover of the book, we get lowercase E.E. Cummings. But then in the text, you revert to normal spellings because this is Susan Cheever's book, not E.E. Cummings' book.
That's right. Although he usually used uppercase to write out his name. In other words, he was very aware that the use of the lowercase was a stylistic thing, not something that he was wedded to. And he was very eager for it not to be perceived as tricksy, his word.
But you get the feeling that there were two E. Cummings, the poet who lowercase, the man, capital E.E.C. And as the daughter of a famous writer and accomplished writer yourself, did you experience your dad in that double way?
Well, it's such a good question, Leonard. I certainly experienced my father as a lowercase I, but it helps that my father was a really good friend of E.E. Cummings. Mm-hmm. So they were a couple of lowercase I's, you know, having a ball in Greenwich Village in the 1930s. But I think, I don't know what makes you an uppercase person versus a lowercase person, but I think if you think about it, you know right away who's an uppercase person and who's a lowercase person.
Because he was a friend of your father's, had you met him before you read him?
I met him one night, and I wrote about this in the preface of the book. I was a miserable, miserable high school student, flunking out of school, making everybody unhappy, and Cummings came to read at the school where I was so miserable. So my father and I went to hear him, and Cummings hated the school, and we drove him home from the school, which is in Dobbs Ferry, New York, to Patchen Place, and that drive really changed my life.
You stopped at a White Castle hamburger joint?
We stopped at a White Castle, yes. It's still there, actually, in the Bronx. But Cummings took my side. I had been complaining about the school to my parents, and they had been saying, you know, you'll learn to love it there. And Cummings said, it's a terrible place. It's a training ground for the idiotic wives of bloviating bankers. He said to my father, of course this spirited young woman hates it there. You know, he was amazing. And he did very funny imitations of the teachers who had been torturing me and had very funny things to say and very scathing things to say about the system of English education that was torturing me. And after that, I got to go to a different kind of school. My father actually listened to him.
Well, you get the feeling that the essence of Cummings was revealed in this, a despiser of social mores, a seeker of freedom, anti-authoritarian, lover of literature, a sympathizer.
A sympathizer, but only to lowercase people, to go back to her. A lowercase sympathizer. For instance, when he went to Russia in 1933, he saw at once that Stalin was a devil and that the people who were supposedly so happy under him were not happy at all.
So do you think that that experience that you had with him was one of the inspirations for going back and considering writing a book about him?
It was definitely one of the reasons why I went back to write a book about him. And it also was one of the reasons I became a writer. In other words, sitting in the back seat of that secondhand Dodge, listening to Cummings talk to my father was just so thrilling, and he was so thrilling. And, you know, before that, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And he held out the promise of a free life, of a playful life, of a life where you just were laughing so hard you could hardly believe it. And that, of course, got me hooked.
Well, did you have any idea of the complications of his life? You say free life. I almost wanted to say free love.
Well, I didn't have any idea of the complications of his life, but certainly one of the things that drove Cummings, that drove him away from Harvard, where he had gotten 2 degrees, and as I said, his father was a professor, and his parents were set up on a blind date by William James. I mean, this is really
and
Harvard.
And his mother knitted him a sweater when he was an infant
exactly.
with a big H on
exactly.
it, so he had to go to Harvard.
If it had
been a Y, he would have had to go to Yale.
Well, but he lived 2 blocks from Harvard, so there was also... But, you know, one of the things that that drove him away from Harvard was his passion for sex, his erotic nature, and what he said he worshipped at the shrine of progressive corporeal revelation. That means strip clubs, right? So he was very funny about it, but he loved sex and he loved naked women and he loved watching women get naked.
And there were strip clubs at that time?
Well, there was the Old Howard in Boston, which he discovered to the horror of his parents. But there were, at Harvard, there was nothing like that.
Susan Cheever is my guest. She's written E.E. Cummings, A Life. It is published by Pantheon. So when did he become a poet?
You know, he was almost born a poet. He was a very beloved son. And his first poem, I can't quite recite it, but it's something about a little bird with his toe. And his mother wrote it down immediately and put it in a scrapbook. So he was sort of born a poet. He had the Cummings household in Cambridge was full of people. Two extended families, Cummings families, lived there. And one of the people who lived there was his fabulous Uncle George, who was a poet and who gave
him
an
amateur poet.
Yes. And who gave him his first, although in those days the distinction wasn't quite so sharp, who gave him his first book of rhymes and who encouraged him. And so I think he was always a poet.
Well, you list his influences as Ezra Pound, James Joyce, the Greek poets, and the Crazy Cat comic strip.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think by the time, you know, Cummings got to Harvard and he learned more about poetics than most people know. And so once he started studying it, then he became obsessed with the idea of doing things first and doing things differently. And he really became a modernist at Harvard. In other words, he learned about what other poets were doing. And he also went to New York and saw Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase. So that whole idea of an image being broken up, whether it's on the page or on the canvas, was very much part of the world in which he lived.
But breaking up is something that you also deal with here, about Cummings facing his divided self and sometimes being sabotaged by it.
Well, he was a complicated man.
It's interesting that William James was part of their lives because he wrote about the divide itself.
He did. Homo duplex. Exactly.
Now, Cummings sees himself as part of this new modernist movement and associates himself with people related to it. But do you think that that also affected the way he lived his private life, the menage a trois that he had?
Well, I think that modernism and bohemianism sort of went together historically. Whether they belonged together, that's another book that maybe you can write, Leonard. But what happened was he grew up at Harvard, and then he decided that Harvard was way too puritanical and way too stringent and way too xenophobic for him. So he went to Greenwich Village, and he hit Greenwich Village at a moment at Greenwich Village's moment of maximum glory, maximum sexuality, maximum open marriages. You know, William Carlos Williams would commute in from New Jersey to suck up the vibes in Greenwich Village. It was really a time when people thought you could fashion whatever personal life you wanted. So his ménage à trois, to which you are referring, was fairly normal.
Well, he'd also been to Paris during World War I, gotten in trouble in Paris. But Paris was probably a lot freer sexually at that time than
that's why
the rest
he
of the United
loved
States.
Paris. He loved it.
But he wound up in a concentration camp.
Well, that wasn't because he got in trouble in Paris. You couldn't get in trouble in Paris. He joined the ambulance corps, which, you know, a branch of the ambulance corps, which had essentially been established for Ivy Leaguers. And by the time he got there, he was on the Western Front, an extremely dangerous place, a few miles from the Somme, right? By the time he got there, he spoke pretty good French, and he was very sympathetic to the French. And, you know, the commander of his unit was a garage mechanic from Des Moines, and who hated the French. And Cummings started expressing his opinions both about how wonderful the French were and about how demoralized the French were and about what an idiot this guy was. And he didn't realize that he was being watched. He didn't realize that that was treason. And he and his friend Slater Brown were writing letters home saying, the French are demoralized, this guy's an idiot. And they ended up, being thrown into jail.
We're getting back to the ménage à trois, which, of course, is fascinating. He wound up having a child with his friend's wife, Elaine. And then many years later, he met his daughter, who was a fan. And
yes.
She fell in love with him and had no idea that this is almost like a soap opera.
Well,
he had to then tell her, no,
your
honey,
soap opera is my, Sophocles. I mean, I think that story... What that story says to me is that there is such a thing as fate, that there is such a thing as – that there are magnetic forces that we don't understand because his daughter did essentially get abducted by her mother. He didn't see his daughter for more than – almost three decades. And then when he did – He sort of ran into her through a series of almost unbelievable coincidences. She took the last boat from England before World War II. She ended up working for someone who was friends of his friend, the James family. It ended up being very hot. The woman, she ended up, Nancy Cummings' daughter, ended up falling in love with and marrying her employer's son. So that kind of brought her into the James family. And she decided to go to New Hampshire, where it was cooler, to stay with the Jameses. And, of course, the Jameses' place was right down the road from the Cummings place. So Cummings heard through the grapevine that his daughter was just up the road.
He knew who she was. She didn't know who he
was. Exactly. And he didn't quite know what to do about it.
Luckily, it all worked out.
Yes,
okay.
I just
we have very little time. And what we haven't talked about is the poetry. He wrote most of his famous poems while he was still young. What happened? Why did he lose it?
Not at all. I think some of the later poems are extraordinary. My father moved through Dooms of Love, which is a pretty late poem. Here Up It Does, Me Up It Does, Out of the Floor, A Poisoned Mouse, which is a very late poem. No, I don't think he lost it at all. I think it got more powerful and less frequent.
But then he is not as respected now as he was. We're starting to re-examine Robert Frost's work. Do you think the same thing is going to happen with Cummings?
I hope so. You know, over and over people say to me, oh, I read him in high school and then I never went back. But let me say, he rewards a visit.
Susan Cheever will be speaking with Billy Collins and Blair Brown at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts tonight at 6 o'clock. That's at Amsterdam Avenue between 64th and 65th Streets. They'll be talking about E.E. Cummings, who is the subject of her latest book called E.E. Cummings, A Life. It is published by Pantheon. And Susan, it's always a pleasure to have you on our show.
Nice.
Thank you so much.
Nice to see you, and congratulations on your 29th anniversary. That is amazing.